to you from the West Coast. This is our occasional, maybe more often now, Politico's Deep Dive. Every week we discuss what's happening this week in politics, but this is an episode where we get to dive in a bit deeper, as it were, on one specific issue. I'm Ian.
And I'm Scott.
And this month we're going to look at the NDP leadership race, considering the voting starts in a few days. Today is September 14th, and we're hoping to have this out fairly soon for patrons, and shortly after that for everyone else. But first, we should do a big thanks to all the patrons who helped us reach our goal, so we actually have to produce more content for you. I hope you like it. And of course, a special thanks to our premier patron, Lindsay Teds, who you can hear on episode 52 that we just put up this afternoon. To give a bit of an overview of how we're going to run through this episode, we're going to talk, I guess, just a bit about the rules, maybe compare them with the Conservative leadership race. We did a deep dive back in...
It was February or March?
Yeah, early in the year on that. Then we'll talk about each of the candidates. I think we'll just do alphabetical order by surname, because that's how they're on the ballot. We'll talk about the state of the race, as far as we can tell, from the limited data out there. And then Scott will tell me how I should vote. First up, the rules of the race. This is the NDP, so there's fewer people, less money, and just a view you should have a lower bar to get in. But even that wasn't low enough for the first possible entry into the race. I think we talked about this back in the time when Sherry DeNovo initially announced her intention to run. DeNovo being an Ontario member of the provincial parliament. But then she saw the $30,000 registration fee and went, that's not socialist enough, I'm out. But that's what the registration fee is. We did end up getting four people paying it. Those people had to collect 500 signatures from NDP members. They had to get 50 from each of five regions. 50% of their signatures had to be from female identifying members. And 100 had to come from other equity seeking groups. People with disabilities, Indigenous people, LGBTQ people, etc. There's a $1.5 million spending limit, and so the race has been just less money thrown at it, at least, than the Conservative leadership race. In terms of the dates, the membership cutoff was August 17th, so if you don't have a card, you're just listening to this for fun. The last chance to compare and contrast the candidates is going to be at the Candidate Showcase on September 17th in Hamilton, which is the day before voting officially starts. I guess this is less of a debate and more of a talent show, something? No one really knows. They've done about six or seven debates across the country, including here in Vancouver this past weekend. And you can watch those all on YouTube if you really want to at ndp.ca/leadership-2017. Voting is a little bit different. It's just a simple one member, one vote, unlike the Conservative system, which weights by riding. That's actually a good system for the electoral system we have, since you have to get support from across the country. This one, if you sign up 200,000 members in Toronto, you can win this race. No one did. Jagmeet Singh came close, but we'll get to that. It's also a ranked ballot, like most other leadership races, so you pick off your top one, two, three. You can rank your fourth candidate for some reason, even though that
mathematically doesn't make any sense or is redundant.
Yeah. But there's also two ways to vote. So I have my ballot sitting here, and I can either fill that in and mail it back. If I do that, I'm locked in. I can't change my vote at any point. But you can also vote online because there's a little code. And you can do that between September 18th and October 1st for the first round. And then that evening, they announce the winner of the first round in Toronto. If you vote online, then you can go back the next week and change your ballot if you want. If you decided, oh, actually, I meant so-and-so for my second choice. Or who was my first choice now isn't, if they're still in the race. You could do all kinds of weird things, which could make the result wonky, but I doubt that many people will be changing around. But you can change your second place vote between October 2nd and 8th. And if we have to have that result, that'll be announced on October 8th in Montreal. And finally, if there's a third round, voting for that's October 9th to 15th, with the absolute final result in Ottawa that night. Unlike the BC Liberal leadership race, losing NDP candidates are not required to pledge their undying love and affection to the great leader. I mean, they all will to some extent. Maybe Jagmeet will go back to Ontario, which is the fear, but even that's not breaking away from the party.
Yeah, so the rules are fairly straightforward, but like I said, the online voting thing's the weirdest part of it all. And especially, it seems like a weird thing to be doing in 2017, where security of online systems is questionable. And, you know, granted, I can't imagine the Russians are that interested in who gets to run the third place will never be prime minister party in Canada, but it still doesn't seem like the best idea, just from, you know, a general point of pragmatism.
Yeah, the last couple, at least the last NDP leadership race in 2011, when Thomas Mulcair won it, was an online ballot. And I don't remember hearing any issues there. There's been one issue this time with 600 people getting two ballots, some because they're in the system as both Tom Stevenson and Thomas Stevenson, for example, or one person had their first and middle name and their first and last name on separate ballots. One person just got two ballots with the same name and different membership numbers. But the party is kind of making its defense. Look, we sent out 124,000 ballots. The fact there's less than 1% error is pretty damn good for anyone. I mean, the Conservatives had their own number of issues. And 600 ballots probably won't swing this. It wasn't quite enough to swing the Conservative race. It was getting close, though.
It was pretty tight at the end there.
So, the online thing, I'm less worried about it at leadership races, which ultimately, especially in a race like this where all the candidates are sort of in the same mold, none of them is against a $15 an hour minimum wage for federal employees, or, you know, none of them is going to blow up the party intentionally. So there's almost no incentive for anyone outside the country, even if the NDP was on the cusp of forming government next time. Well, maybe then there'd be different candidates, but it's a nice place to testbed online voting and see how well it can work. I think the weird thing is definitely this week-by-week announcement of rounds, and I think that's their attempt to make it a bit more exciting.
Well, I mean, it could use the excitement. I mean, I think most Canadians have more or less tuned out the leadership race so far.
I think this past week has been the most attention, especially since Jagmeet's heckled by a racist went viral. But yeah, anything they can do to try to get some excitement. It also means they spend a lot more hosting three parties, which all happen to be in the center of Canada, I guess, Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa. So let's jump into a bit about the candidates. Do you want to start with what I wrote here on Charlie Angus, as in stole from Wikipedia and his policy page?
Yes, Charlie Angus is the MP for Timmins James Bay. He's been in Parliament since 2004. Former punk rocker and labor activist, and has served as credit for Indigenous and Northern Affairs.
I found an interesting story about Charlie that I didn't actually remember at the time, but in 2005, when Parliament was having its votes on same-sex marriage, he announced, like all New Democrats, he was going to vote in favor of same-sex marriage.
Well, not all New Democrats. There was the MP that Nikki Ashton ended up unseating.
Yeah, he wasn't a New Democrat anymore. So, well, Charlie genuinely supported the bill, but he's also a Catholic, and his local priest threatened to deny him communion for the vote, and Charlie said, no, I'm standing up for a marginalized group, and that's been his background. I heard him just on the Huffington Post follow-up podcast today talking about how his whole background is basically just being a punk rock social justice advocate. He moved to Northern Ontario with his wife just for an adventure, even when the mining town was closed. For a while, he ran a house for the homeless. He fought a mine in Northern Ontario that was polluting local lakes. He says the home he has there, he can't swim in the lake because of the pollution there. So he's always been this activist, just jumping into everything. His biggest file, though, has been Indigenous issues. When you hear him speak and talk about First Nations issues or otherwise, he just almost gets fiery, like moral outrage about the issue. So unsurprisingly, that's been a core focus of the policy he's talked about. He has a whole section about Indigenous issues. One of the key things he talks about in there is creating an Indigenous children's ombudsperson, and he hammers at every chance he can the fact that the federal Liberals are fighting Human Rights Commission rulings saying they need to fund Indigenous reserves more to make up for terrible conditions there. And he says, why is the federal government, who says they're in favor of reconciliation, fighting First Nations people in courts? So he's very strong on that. He also talks, interestingly, about the need for a government audit of essentially everything it's doing with respect to Indigenous people. Like, where's all the money going? Is it being used effectively? And this is something that I think conservatives could get around, and I think could also be like a flag for some New Democrats who go, an audit could be a sign of like, let's cut money out of that program. But I think his view is, let's make sure we're doing things effectively and not just throwing money in the pit and not helping anyone. On climate change, he hasn't officially, he's the only candidate who's not really officially against every pipeline in existence. He does have a different approach. He wants to put in a national carbon budget and basically create a hard cap on emissions for the country and then create some bureaucracy to make sure we don't extend past that.
Though that does get a little complicated when you get into the fact that a lot of the emissions areas fall under provincial jurisdiction. So I haven't exactly seen how that gets addressed.
Yeah, some of the other candidates talk more about doing Justin Trudeau's plan, but plus and faster. So working with provinces to reach a national climate target and essentially a price on carbon, but whatever that means in a specific province. His plan is at least a bit more comprehensive than just saying no to resource development because you don't want the carbon getting out there. It's saying, look, we have to have max, however you get up to there, it's fine. And realistically, a finite budget would probably kill some of the pipelines, especially if it counted carbon emitted by the products we export.
Although the how you get there is a fairly complicated question of allocation that's basically sounds like it has to be a cap and trade model or some version of cap and heavily bureaucratized and centrally planned.
The NDP is not afraid of central planning, Scott.
Yes, it just doesn't work too well a lot most of the time.
The next segment of his policy is this housing is a right approach, and he wants to put a lot of effort into building affordable homes, creating a low-income housing benefit, and he actually wants to make a firm commitment to ending homelessness in Canada. This is something I've heard lots of mayors, including our own here in Vancouver, make.
I don't know. That works out.
I'm going to say I don't know of any who've been successful. I think it's a nice ambition. And I like the idea of a housing as a right being the sort of approach. That's not to say you have to own a home. You should be able to have a roof over your head. Shelter seems like a pretty...
Yeah, I don't like the as a right part of that. Because when you're looking at a significant government expenditure, it comes down to a question of how do you allocate finite resources? And it's probably a good policy, but maybe not as a right rather than as a priority or as something we should be focusing on. Because once you start using the as a right and make it right, you lose a lot of flexibility. And it doesn't allow you to deal with the inherent trade-offs that come with prioritizing government budgets.
In the HuffPo podcast I mentioned, he brings up this housing as a right, and the host, I think it's Althea Raj, asks him, if that would mean, because he's also talked about opening up the Constitution again to get Quebec to sign it. And there are one or two other candidates who touched on that, not as a like, we should do this tomorrow, but like long term, maybe shutting down the Quebec idea of talking about the Constitution shouldn't happen. Like, and Althea Raj asked Charlie straight up, so should housing be put in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms? And he goes, it's an aspiration. I think if we put it in there explicitly, it might he didn't say backfire, but
it'll probably in practice, it'll probably backfire.
Considering how far the Charter of Rights and Freedoms has gone and how many different cases that we could not have predicted in 1982 or the late 70s when they were writing it, it's an aspiration, though, and it's a commendable one.
So another part of it's he wants to put in a national low-income housing benefit. So that would cover 75% of the gap between the actual cost and a reasonable rate of rental geared towards income. Plan on investing $1.1 billion per year to help roughly 1 million people, which when you work it out the numbers, that turns out to about $91 per month per person, which... Like, in Vancouver, I'm not sure $91 a month is going to be the difference between, or even 75% of the difference between secure housing and market rents.
Angus has a couple other big policies that I really like. He's one of the only candidates to really talk about party renewal at the grassroots. And a lot of NDP members have this bitterness about the party brass. I think in 2011, we ended up with Mulcair, and we're hopeful, at least, even if you didn't vote for him, that he and the big wigs inside the party could turn that from official opposition into government, or at least hold the fort. And instead, when they lost ground and ran an objectively bad campaign when it shouldn't have been, it seemed easy not to fuck that up. There's this bitterness. Listen to people. Listen to the members. Even Jack Layton's sort of approach ultimately became more about centralizing power to make the NDP more efficient and more electable, frankly. But at some point, it maybe went too far that way till it became almost indistinguishable from the Liberals, at which point people just vote for real Liberals. So Charlie actually has an approach that wants to look at re-engaging individual members across the country. And I'll give him full credit for that. He's also one who wants to really up cooperatives. So if a business closes, he would give the workers the legal first right to buy it and turn it into a co-op.
Yeah, so that got a fair bit of attention. I think the kind of economic lefty part of the NDP really liked that when it got announced.
Well, but I think it has the sound of, like, let's create a socialist economy without... actually the nationalizing.
Yeah. It's a fair bit of problems when you start doing that.
I don't think there's anyone in the NDP who wants the Stalinist state. But the more cooperative owned is just attractive.
But, you know, I think a lot of the cooperative stuff tends to get romanticized a fair bit. Because, you know, right now there's nothing that actually stops cooperatives from forming. And, you know, there's nothing in theory that would stop the workers from being of a plant, being able to raise the money and, in theory, buy it. But, you know, there's some decent organizational reasons why they don't always work out super efficiently. And it's just one of those things where it's not actually like a major policy barriers to it right now. So it's one of those things, you know, I think if it was really as great as the NDP seems to think it is, we actually see it emerge more often.
Well, it was partially what I was thinking when I actually read it. It sounds really great at first. It's like, oh, yeah, of course workers should be able to buy the businesses. But then I was thinking, how many businesses close in a situation where the workers would want to take it over? There's a good example on Vancouver Island of a pulp paper mill that shut down a number of years ago, except the workers actually managed to get together and buy it out. Same thing happened with Czech News, that was formerly owned by Global or CTV.
I think it got traded around a few times.
Yeah, it got passed around. Eventually, it was going to be shut down and the workers took it over, following the paper mill's example. But aside from those two and a couple other good examples you could probably find, this isn't like a drastic overhaul of Canadian society. It would.
Yeah, and like a lot of these times, you know, owners of businesses tend not to like to shut down one of their main sources of revenue and income. So, you know, if a place is shutting down, there's probably a good reason for it. And even if it is competition from elsewhere, the fact that it's now owned by the workers doesn't make it more competitive. So I'm not sure that there's necessarily a huge opportunity for workers to then sink their own personal assets in a lot of these cases into acquiring a business that is not doing well. So, which is probably why you don't see it happen too often. So, and I'm not sure that Charlie Angus's plan will actually, you know, make that much more attractive.
It's nice rhetoric, maybe not a big overhaul of the economy. He's actually got one of the thinner policy sections on his website. Might just be because he's and his team have spent more time talking about it and then forgetting to put things online, which I've heard from a couple of the candidates, I should have put that on my website. Of course you should have. That's where we're going.
And isn't that what campaign staffers are for?
Yeah. That's what we basically pulled off of Charlie's website. I think he's, in terms of his strengths, and with each candidate, we'll do a bit of the bio policy like we just did, do strengths, weaknesses, and path to victory. Charlie's strengths are just his long record in Parliament. He's the most experienced candidate. And I find he just has a really folksy Canadian, like rural Ontario charm to him. Like he is a fantastic storyteller. Feels like you want to just have beers with him. And on top of that, he's just the strongest on Indigenous issues, which is something that's been sorely overpromised and underdelivered by the Liberals. And I would just say underdelivered by the Harper Conservatives. So I think he can run on a strong track record there. That said, his French is kind of bad. It's gotten better, and I've heard he's in lessons, but it does kind of come with that accent of the person who learned French later in life. He's, within the NDP, also seen as a bit softer on pipelines because of his bit more nuanced, potentially, take on climate issues. And maybe it's positive, maybe it's a negative. He's maybe the more moderate or establishment candidate, but he's also got that renewal. There is no, as far as I can tell, like establishment candidate where all of the bigwigs of the party have centered. Charlie's got a number of endorsements, but so does everyone else. So if you really hate how the campaign was run last time, well, you're in luck that there's no Mulcair, but I don't know where his people are if that's what you're really trying to avoid. So for Angus to win, I think he has a good shot. He's one of the front runners, one of two. It's a bit tricky to figure out where he is relative to Jagmeet Singh being the other one. I think if Angus gets a pretty strong first ballot showing, either in first or just behind in second, he can pick up a lot of second place ballots from especially the older NDP members, the people who've been in the party a while. They'll just trust him more than Jagmeet. Not that it's entirely a race thing for the older people, but just Charlie's been in the federal party longer, whereas Jagmeet, the hip young guy coming from Ontario who's not even necessarily committed to staying in the federal level. And Charlie's also in parliament versus Jagmeet's still in Ontario and not really committed to running at the federal level. So Charlie's got a good shot. So that's Charlie Angus. Well, next up, Nikki Ashton. On episode 45 of Politicoast, I sat down and interviewed Nikki Ashton. We spoke for 40 minutes, threw in some of your questions. We also did a little bit of follow-up on that, I think. So her bio is in there. A lot of her policy stuff is already in there. I'm just going to refer back to that. Go and listen to that. Since then, she's put out a couple more, two or three more positions. She has put out her electoral reform position, which is, as with all of them, mixed member proportional with regional lists. She says explicitly open lists, which means you get to rank the individual candidates rather than the party ranks them for you. There are benefits and weaknesses of both. One is a bit more like democratic and you get to choose which candidate. The other is a bit more easy of a ballot because you don't have multiple dozen regional candidates to choose from.
Especially depending on how it's broken down. You know, if it's on, you do it provincially, you know, you're looking at over 100 on the Ontario list, which gets to be a bit challenging. Yeah.
The only other difference that I saw in Nikki Ashton's electoral reform policy was she didn't mention the word referendum at all. I don't know if that means she just wouldn't do one or if she just would bring it in and then we have it. Nikki's other recent policy, she put out a pretty comprehensive position on people with disabilities. Basically making both the party itself more accessible and making sure it's available and inclusive of people of all abilities, as well as if she formed government, making sure hiring was open to people with disabilities and listening to activists and people with disabilities themselves to find out what else to do. Her other big position was on harm reduction. So she looked to fight discrimination around HIV and make sure we can treat people with HIV and AIDS more equitably in the healthcare system. She would expand the use of safe consumption sites and harm reduction when it comes to street drugs, I guess. And she'd take a pretty strong stance in favor of sex workers' rights and trying to take a harm reduction approach to sex work rather than a criminal justice, I guess, approach. None of those are unexpected policies for Nikki Ashton, but ones that I'm sympathetic to. Nikki's whole overall approach has been to be the Bernie Corbyn movement candidate, to try to really emphasize the grassroots left-wing part of the NDP, a strength that she doesn't get a ton of credit, but she's luckily not gotten any criticism for, is the fact she's done this campaign pregnant now with twins. She actually had to Skype into the last debate because she's at a point in her pregnancy where it doesn't make sense to travel. I'm actually quite impressed with how the NDP managed to Skype her in and still make sure that she wasn't totally marginalized out of the debate, because it's difficult to do a round back and forth when you have a 3-second delay on your video screen, as it looked like she had. So the moderator was great in letting her in. She's also got a strength of having run before. So she had a machine to run off of and managed to actually start not from zero, but could work off of that.
Build on that last place finish.
Running teaches you stuff no matter where you finish. She may not be last this time. She's got a fairly detailed policy platform. I was thinking it was one of the most detailed until I flipped through all of them and realized how much they'd put up since I had last gone through. But of course, the issue with Nikki is she is seen as abrasive by many and is maybe too radical to be elected.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've made it a secret that she's probably my least favorite candidate amongst them. And I have plenty of criticisms of her platform, which I can go back to episode 45 and get a decent snapshot of those. And yeah, there's definitely been a few, I think, missteps on her part that kind of add to that appearance of abrasiveness or radicalism that doesn't necessarily mesh with where most Canadians are. She didn't come out of the Elbowgate thing looking particularly well. Kim Truss is a little ridiculous. There's the whole Beyonce quoting thing, which, you know, wasn't a huge deal, but kind of it played into an existing narrative with her that I don't think really aligns with where most Canadians are on whether or not quoting a incredibly popular mainstream singer qualifies as cultural appropriation and should be avoided.
I'll give her credit and put out the argument for her on that one, at least, in that the approach she took was she got criticism from an activist movement that she had been claiming support of. She had been saying from the start, you know, she's the candidate of Black Lives Matter, Idle No More, and all these other movements. And so when one of those movements criticizes her, she either has to look like a hypocrite and say, I don't care what you have to say, or she had to sort of take their position to heart. She could have pushed back, maybe, but I think she took a look at it and went, you know what? It's better, just easier for me to say,
yeah,
all right, I'll take your position. And fine, it plays into that narrative, but she's not going to win the, quote, cultural conservative vote no matter what. And I realize there's a lot of moderates.
Yeah, there's the moderates still in between there, them. But at the same time, I think that just is kind of an example of how if you're not already on board with Nikki Ashton, you're not going to find her that appealing or probably not going to be won over.
Some people go to where the electorate is. Some people hope the electorate comes to them. Pull society in the radical direction.
Yeah. And, well, that's kind of what Bernie and Corbyn have tried to do. I think the NDP and particularly the Ashton Winnipeg looked at them probably a little too fondly because while they performed better than expected, it's worth remembering they neither of them have won. But yeah, the thing is with her on a ranked ballot, I just can't see her doing that well pulling in the second and third place. And at the same time, should she win, I can't see her really propelling the party forward at all.
I had almost the most trouble with figuring out her path to victory because there realistically almost isn't one. She basically needs to beat at least Angus or Singh in the first round, if not both of them.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, it's not only that she has to place in the top two in the first round, she needs first by a good, safe margin because she's probably not going to be scooping up the majority of the second and third place votes. Next up, we have Dietron, the MP for Rimouski from Quebec, who's been in the House since 2011. It's been critic for Finance and Atlantic Canada's Opportunity Agency.
Which he had to be because there were no NDP MPs from Quebec or from Atlantic Canada.
Well, in this past one, yeah. There were plenty in the 2011 to 2015.
I think it's only recently he had the latter critic role, though.
Yeah, and Rimouski's on the St. Lawrence Gulf, so it's Atlantic-ish, even if it's not generally considered Atlantic Canada. So, yeah, his background is as an economist and researcher and worked for the Communication, Energy, and Paper Workers Union.
He was a student activist when he was in college. He was president of the Canadian Federation for Students for 2 terms. CFS has quite the reputation as being the more radical sort of national body of students. I know at the 2 universities I've been a student at, there have been constant debates about whether or not to maintain membership in CFS just because of how radical it gets at times and whether it's a good use of student money.
I have heard that can be quite controversial. I was lucky, I guess, in that I didn't have to deal with that at my university, but it has been more than a little controversial on a few campuses.
So he's not going to win the student conservative vote, but Guy Caron has also been with the Council of Canadians and worked as a journalist. So Caron made big sort of policy news because his first big thing was talking about basic income when no one else did. And still no one else really has. Jagmeet's talked about a couple specific
and
limited basic income bits,
Nikki Ashton has denounced it as a neoliberal conservative plot.
She said she's skeptical of things that right-wingers like. She hasn't denounced it entirely. But in terms of Guy Caron's approach, his basic income would be checks for anyone who is below the low-income cutoff. So that's a fixed statistic that takes into account regional variations, which is good for Canada because it doesn't make sense to give someone living in Saskatoon the same check as you get in downtown Vancouver. Guy Caron's approach would also not gut the social safety net like some plans, those that Nikki's a bit more skeptical of, I think, where it's let's replace all the social safety net with one check for everyone. And because it would be based on a cutoff, I guess it's not a universal basic income, it's just a check for
the guaranteed poor. Minimum income, it's the term.
There's, different terms of it.
Yeah, the basic income crowd, all niche groups, has crazy specific vocabulary for everything.
So Guy actually has a lot of spending in his platform. He's got a very thorough platform, to be sure. He's a policy wonk and a nerd. I think I'll start with how he's going to pay for this all, which is just overhaul of the tax system. So I think he and Lindsay Tedds, while they might not agree on some of the politics of it, would be really happy together. He wants to introduce a lot more taxes, but he also just wants to overhaul the entire tax code. So he'd bring in a number of new taxes. He'd raise the corporate tax from 15 to 19%. He's not the only one who would do that.
I think everyone on the NDP, it's like the $15 minimum wage. If you have an NDP membership, you basically support it and are calling for it.
Probably in party policy, in one of the member approved documents, and you never go against those. Sometimes you don't promise to do that. You just go, it's in there. And in a magic fairy world, we'll do everything in policy. But for the most part. They find their own things. Guy Caron would bring in a financial activities tax. I think that's the Robin Hood style tax, a wealth tax, and an inheritance tax, and a few others. He'd also set up a tax crime division within the Justice Department to basically go after tax criminals. And this overhaul, I guess, would pay for the billions of dollars of spending he has proposed.
Yeah, he would also raise the price of carbon up to $150 by 2030.
Yeah, so his carbon plan is Justin Trudeau's, but 2 years faster, as far as...
And continuing on a lot, yeah, beyond that to, well, basically the same level Michael Chan had it, though this isn't an offset with other taxes the way his was.
Which... in either case, makes sense. If the goal of a carbon tax is to get us off carbon, it needs to keep going until we're not using carbon anymore, or until we're not emitting. So credit to him for being committed to killing the fossil fuel industry, because it's what needs to happen.
And speaking of which, he's also going to end fossil fuel subsidies, which is just a good idea, regardless of where you sit on the how active we should be combating climate change part. It's just dumb to subsidize that.
One other thing I thought was a bit interesting in his tax slash climate plan was he talked about bringing in this carbon border adjustment tax. It sounds like a tariff that if another country doesn't tax the carbon of a product that's made, we would add that to it. And I don't know if we could do that to some of the countries we've made free trade agreements with.
Yeah, that's a little more wonky than I think either of us can really touch on, but in theory it's not a bad idea. Just that is one of the concerns, and one of the legitimate concerns about a carbon tax is it does not so much reduce as shift where the carbon is emitted. So having some sort of adjustment isn't the worst idea, but yeah, you do get into a tricky-ish area with some of that stuff.
He's also opposed to all the pipelines and would phase out fossil fuel cars over the long term. He wants to see 50% electric cars on the road by 2041, which is consistent with a couple other countries that are on the path there and have been on the path there for a little while. And Canada's a bit behind.
And it's not a crazy unreasonable time. You basically need 20 years to get a sizable chunk of the vehicle fleet replaced, so it's not unreasonable.
He would also look to throw $10 billion at electric high-speed trains between Edmonton and Calgary, which is way overdue, as well as a Quebec City to Windsor line that would connect Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa in there.
Basically the only two places high-speed rail makes sense in Canada. The more interesting part is he wants this not just for passengers, but freight, which struck me as weird because the faster you move something, the more energy it's going to require. So it's going to be less green regardless of how you do it. And for most items, speed is not the essential part. It's going to be cost. So I can't see the business case for a high-speed rate for most things. It's going to be a very niche market.
I'll agree with that. Outside of taxes and environment, he has a $90 billion jobs plan. That's split over 10 years, but $9 billion a year to help create new jobs across the economy. He really wants to not just overhaul our taxes. He's one of the ones who's actually looked at what the effects of automation might be and talked about overhauling the workforce. So he's proposed making it a 7-hour workday instead of 8, and making sure no one loses a dollar pay for that.
Yeah, which is in effect a 12% increase in wages.
I think the goal is to try to look at more employment rather than more hours.
But my concern with that is, of course, if you suddenly increase everyone's wages by 12%, you know, you're going to increase the incentive to automate a lot of those jobs. I'm wondering how good it's going to be as a counter-automation policy.
You could also argue that most of us don't actually put a good 40 hours of productive work in a week. I mean, I do, obvious. Well, I work 32 hours. That's my pay rate right now. But if there's an hour a day you could cut out and just make the other 7 more productive? Come on, you could do that, Scott. I think it's a good idea, and there are countries where the work week isn't 40 hours. A lot of European countries have shorter work weeks, and it is a big idea, and I think the NDP is looking for newer and bigger ideas. And I'll give them props for that. Moving on to Guy's electoral reform plan, I credit it to him because Jagmeet Singh explicitly called it Guy's plan and said it's a good one that he's just going to adopt wholeheartedly. Guy's plan is this mixed member proportional with regional list. He would say it's the first bill he's going to bring in because you have to be explicit in running on electoral reform and proportional representation, especially after Justin Trudeau said he was for electoral reform, but then killed it because turns out Canadians weren't for his electoral reform. So then we'd have proportional representation, and he'd give us 2 elections under it. I'm not sure what the rationale for 2 elections rather than just 1, as I think New Zealand did, but maybe the first one is just like a bitter, we didn't like you changing the system.
Also, we're still figuring this out, so any hiccups with, you know, people not understanding it or Elections Canada not being ready to process it or count the ballots quickly or whatever, those can get ironed out a bit.
You also get 2 elections, and then you have to come back to this question basically 8 years before you get your referendum on your system, in which case you have a new generation of voters deciding whether or not they like this thing they've only ever known. Mind you, young people never vote, so it's not that much of an issue.
Yeah, it also has the risk that, after 8 years, a government starts to get a little less popular.
He's not saying 2 NDP elections. He's just saying 2 elections, period. But then you're also relying on other parties to implement your referendum.
Well, you could put in the legislation at the time, but
which can be overruled by another bill. It has some wrinkles in the plan, let's say. I like it still as a plan, and it's clear, and much clearer than Justin Trudeau's. We will have this be the last first past the post election until it's not. The other part of his plan is that any minority parliament that happens, he would make this a condition, one of the red lines, not the only red line, but it would be one of the red lines to an alliance with any other party is electoral reform. And in that case, he says he'd be more open to other systems, STV, whatever, but it would have to have some element of proportionality as far as I can tell. Guy's other big position, and one that separates him from anyone else, being the Quebec-only candidate, he has a Quebec-specific plan for the NDP, and this has also been one of his most controversial. I think it's full credit to him for developing a Quebec plan. I think Quebec is going to play a big role if the NDP ever wants to form government. But this plan is something that I think English Canadians will bristle at. For example, the first position is to apply Bill 101 to all Quebec businesses that are under federal legislation. And Bill 101 is the one that has been ruled unconstitutional, but the Quebec government keeps invoking the notwithstanding clause to uphold, which requires all signs to have at least French in them, and French to be bigger than anything else.
Yeah, as well as there's a bunch of workplace language rules and everything to go with it, and brings up the uncomfortable question of whether a federal NDP government will use the notwithstanding clause for that.
And that's not the most controversial part of his Quebec part. The next one probably is, which is that final decisions on religious symbols rest with the National Assembly. So this is the current Bill 62 debate. Bill 62 is the Quebec National Assembly's bill by, I think, the Liberals, but it has actual cross-partisan support from Quebec Solidaire in some ways to Parti Québécois, to the CAQ, Coalition Avenir Québécois, whatever it is, CAQ, which would prohibit obvious religious garb from being worn when providing or receiving services from the government, aka Muslim hijabs, niqabs, etc., which I personally can't buy as a form of secularism. It's French laïcité, which is we don't want religion in government. And
Which is a little hypocritical when you have a giant cross hanging up in the National Assembly.
And Caron makes the point that historically in Quebec, they had a Catholic theocratic government, and the Quiet Revolution was their breaking free of that. Now their approach to secularism is to make sure no religion comes back and takes over again. But when they think Muslims, who represent 1 to 3% of the Quebec population, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I guarantee you it's not more than 5%, those fears are irrational and based in a xenophobic bigotry. Ultimately, it's not really up to the federal government what the Quebec National Assembly does. And so this whole debate in the NDP is kind of over nothing, because it doesn't really matter if Quebec's National Assembly passes it. Each of the candidates has eventually admitted, yeah, if it's unconstitutional, it goes through the court system. Nikki Ashton's actually finally said that quite well after sort of making this, I support a woman's right to wear what she wants, but then also support Quebec's right to make its wrong decisions. So he does state explicitly he's for a woman's right to wear whatever they want. He's on this, Quebec can decide its secularism and we must respect that, which is his interpretation of the Sherbrooke Declaration, which is the NDP's how do we deal with Quebec question, because the NDP prior to Jack Layton never had much support in Quebec. And that's the same declaration that says basically they'll respect Quebec's approach to sovereignty and self-determination, and also controversially says if Quebecers vote on a question of their own choosing to separate, the NDP would respect a 50% plus one majority, which is honestly more clear than the Clarity Act, which says a clear majority on a clear question should be respected. And I don't know what either of those things mean other than, fine, is a clear majority 50% plus one? Because I guess it's not. But does that mean it's 66% or 75% with 50% turnout? And what's a clear question versus what's an unclear question?
We know the extremes, right? Yeah, but it's a little vague. I personally like the idea of just using an absolute majority threshold, because that would be clear, but that then comes into question of, you know, turnout plays a role in what the actual ratio of yes to no's.
It's like Brexit. Like, Brexit had a 52% yes, and that's frustrating and disappointing, and I really don't want them to because it's the wrong decision, but it's just become the accepted.
But like, there's also, but like, one of the advantages of an absolute majority is, like, I think there's some flooding in South London the day of the vote or something. But like, that way, an absolute majority, you know, you need more than half of Quebecers, not the people who vote. And that way, that would be clear, or it would resolve some of the uncertainty that a situation like that would potentially throw up. But of course, I'm not writing the Clarity Act.
Yeah. Or the Sherbrooke Declaration. So Guy's other couple points for Quebec are to put into law that Supreme Court of Canada judges have to be bilingual, which right now is the convention.
Yes, I think that's a little trickier, especially when it comes to Western Canada, where the bilingualism rate is pretty pitiful. And you know, it does raise some questions about, are you shutting out a lot of otherwise qualified judges who don't speak French fairly well, because nobody speaks French in this part of the country?
The problem is with our Supreme Court of Canada is it is the highest court of two legal systems, two distinct legal systems, and all of their judgments have to be bilingual, and not just translations, but equally valid law in both languages. And if you have nine justices, eight of whom agree on one, and the one who disagrees doesn't happen to be bilingual, you run into a big problem when that person goes to try to write their dissent and can't. And they can work with admin assistants like they will and legal assistants. Then you've taken this judge's job and put it in the intern's hand. So I think I'm actually more sympathetic to this. We are a bilingual country at the federal level, so if you want the highest job, it's kind of what you have to learn. But getting back to Guy and Quebec, uncontroversially, he also wants Quebec to eventually sign the Constitution. He does admit this would be a long-term project. That was sarcasm. Yes, it's very controversial. But he admits, right, this will take more than 25 years probably. He just doesn't think we should not be talking about it because it doesn't make sense to have one of 10 provinces not officially.
And one of 10 provinces, and according to his website, the second largest by area, which is wrong, because it's the largest, which, tangent here, but that was just such a weird little mistake on the website of the Quebec MP in the race.
And finally, he'd hire 10 organizers for the NDP in Quebec to target 60 ridings. So he has an ambitious target. And one thing I heard was, up until Jack Layton, I don't know if the NDP ever had 10 organizers. So it's an ambitious focus on Quebec and try to win Quebec through organizers and doing the work, which is full props to him. And being that the only other person to talk about party organizing was Charlie Angus in a more engaged grassroots way, at least they're both looking at that. And finally, outside of Quebec, Guy has a lot of stuff about creating a nation-to-nation strategy with Indigenous people. So Guy's obvious strength is policy. Even if you don't fully agree with all the details, he has the details. You know what he stands for. He doesn't have a fully costed platform up on his website, but he has more tables with here's how much all of these things will raise. He's thought through all the little side notes. He has more Quebec experience and knowledge of Quebec. And even where I don't agree with him on Quebec, his reasoning is more based on the ground, having grown up and lived there. So he does have those kind of strengths, but those almost strike me more as he needs to be close to whoever wins, because I still don't think he has what it takes to win. He doesn't have the profile. He came in prior to the race. No one knew who he was. Although I think he's got much better name recognition now. I don't find him as charismatic as the others, but there is something to be said for the policy nerd economist type who just knows their stuff inside and out. And I also wonder if his approach to laïcité, as I said, might be off-putting in English Canada, if that sort of Quebec approach.
Yeah, that sort of people. Asymmetric federalism is not the sort of thing that sits well with a lot of English Canada.
Well, asymmetric federalism as an approach is in the Sherbrooke Declaration, so each candidate will definitely.
Yeah, he's just leaned on it a lot more.
Yeah, he's very explicit about it. So there's trade-offs with Guy. Like Nicky Ashton, I see his path to victory being pretty narrow. He can probably pick up more second, third choice ballots, but he still needs a really strong first ballot finish that I don't know if
he can get. Yeah, he's less divisive than Ashton, so I think he does have a better chance of picking up those second, third choice ballots, but.
But he's less inspiring, so he has less chance of getting the first place ballot.
Yeah.
Like, everyone will put him second, because he's, or third, but who's putting him first? I know a few people, but no one hates him. He even ended his last debate with, people started this campaign asking, who is this Guy? But now they're saying, I like this Guy. Which was adorable, but it did make me think, no one's saying, I love this Guy. And finally, let's get into Jagmeet Singh. There's lots we can say here. I'll just start by saying I went to his Burnaby Jagmeet and greet this past week and recorded the stump speech and answers to questions he put out there. And I put that on our Patreon. So I'll turn that to public when this episode goes public, and then people can listen to it there. And you can find that link in the show notes if you want to listen to 55 minutes of Jagmeet Singh talking. He's pretty charming. Jagmeet is an Ontario member of the provincial parliament for Bramalia Gore Malton, which is in the Peel region. He's actually the first NDP provincial politician to be elected in that region. He ran federally just before he was elected in province in 2011, but lost to a conservative candidate by just 539 votes, and this was in the Orange Wave. So he has actual roots in the federal party, which some people have been questioning. He was originally born in Scarborough to Indian immigrants, but he also grew up in St. John's, Newfoundland and Windsor. He has a Bachelor of Science in Biology, which I thought was kind of cool. We have a scientist in the ring. on Charlie's interview on the HuffPo thing, they asked him what his climate targets would be. And he said, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, but I get a bunch of scientists to figure it out and I do what they say, which I respect. After Jagmeet got his Bachelor of Science in Biology, he went into law, got a law degree from Osgoode Law School, and was a criminal defense lawyer doing lots of pro bono activist type work. He's very multilingual with English, French, Hindi, Tamil, and Punjabi under his belt. And speaking of belts, he is a jiu-jitsu and MMA fighter. So if we put him and Justin Trudeau in a ring, I think we know who'd win. And of course, he's well known for being super stylishly dressed and liking to drive fancy cars and getting on cover of GQ and things like that. That said, when I went to his policy pages, he has lots, and they're actually pretty detailed. He does have lots partially because each one he has like the main page, but then each subheading has its own page as well, so some of it's redundant. So I don't actually know which candidate has the most policy. He wants to do lots around work, $15 minimum wage like everyone at the federal level, revamping the labor code. He's worked on issues around temp agencies in Ontario, and he wants to look at that from the federal government as well, how many people in federal regulated businesses are relying on temp agencies rather than hiring full-time employees. He would look to end unpaid internships from the federal government. His most controversial thing, though, is this Canadian Seniors Guarantee, where he wants to combine old age security, the guaranteed income supplement, and two tax credits, the age credit and the pension income credit, together into some hybrid bastardized program that Charlie Angus has gone after him for saying you're going to create a means-tested, no more universal old age security.
As far as I'm concerned, means testing's great, but it's one of the controversial within the NDP.
Yeah, one of the core NDP approaches is always this idea of universality, and especially at the seniors level, Charlie Angus points out there will be seniors who sell their home 1 year, and that's their big income on their tax write-off or tax return. And in that case, they then don't get, or they wouldn't get Jagmeet's OAS.
Although that's just for that year. And, you know, seniors as a age demographic are the most well off of all the demographic in Canada, I believe. And so means testing one of the most well off demographics for a benefit targeted explicitly at that demographic, it's not a terrible idea. And the universality things always strike me as a little weird for the NDP, because it means giving a bunch of money to the well-off who don't need it.
I was thinking earlier today about questions of universality, and while there might be places where it doesn't make sense, I think sometimes it actually, even though it feels like you're giving money to rich people, it's almost easier if, say, your cutoff is at a certain amount. 60% of people end up getting this because most people aren't actually that well-off, then setting up a bureaucracy to test people. And anytime you create any test that you have to apply for, or even the government looks at your income, and if they're wrong, you have to appeal, means that people fall through the cracks. And so there's that sort of injustice about should people fall through the cracks, or should we just fill in the top bit? And it's those kind of questions. And the economics breaks down differently on different questions. So Canadian Seniors Guarantee, I think, is even a bit more convoluted, because when Jagmeet's tried to respond to Charlie Angus's attack, he's called it fake news even, and argued that he's expanding OAS because he would pump more money into it. And OAS is universal versus GIS is means tested already. And so his policy is actually pretty thin on the website on what this exactly is he's proposing, other than roll these together and throw money at it. So I don't know if he's maintaining OAS, but then people below the means test line get extra on top of that, or if the whole thing becomes means tested. It's just not clear, right, between what's on his website and what he said. That's not to say either is right or wrong. That's just to say I don't know.
Yeah, that is a little unfortunate. But circling back to the means test thing a bit, like, it's you know, I just don't see the NDP would accept a flat tax rate, even though they're fine with flat benefits, despite the fact that a progressive income tax, in theory, has more administrative overhead to it.
In terms of taxes, Jagmeet Singh wants to put a whole bunch of taxes for everyone. He's going to create two more tax brackets for the $350,000 plus earners and the $500,000 plus earners. And we had to check the 1% mark for Canadians is about $198,000 a year. So half a percentage of Canadians will face higher taxes under that plan, which also goes to show that it probably won't actually raise that much money.
Yeah, the focus the left can sometimes have on high tax earners is as a revenue-raising tool, I think sometimes
it can just
be overstated.
It might not be a revenue-raising tool so much as a milk-the-rich tool. And
well, you're not getting much milk is the point.
Yeah, you heard it. Compared
to what some people might think.
So he's got a bevy of other taxes he wants to bring in, a capital gains tax increase, new estate tax, corporate taxes back up to where they were 20 years ago, closing a number of loopholes. He would also bring in a tax fairness commission. He points out we haven't really reviewed the Income Tax Act in 50 years. And I think, honestly, this is a good idea. Like, let's go line by line and see if this system still makes sense for an era of ride-sharing apps and gig economies and changing labor markets. In climate, he's got a fairly similar plan to everyone else, pro zero emission vehicles, pro public transit. He focuses on this renewable energy supergrid, which would be a nationalized distribution network, power lines basically, from east to west. The idea itself, I think I'm supportive of. I like the idea. It also makes sense to have big infrastructure projects like that publicly owned rather than trying to wait for private power companies to build. It's not going to happen at that scale. I think it does raise some jurisdictional issues with the provinces. Maybe he could argue it's like a pipeline and therefore
Ottawa would have the regulatory ability to build it. I just don't think they could force the provinces to connect up and take power off it. Which, you know, the provinces would probably be interested, but
The other problem is just engineering-wise, the longer you transmit power, even at high voltages, the more loss you have. So a hydro plant in northern Quebec, I'm not sure how far you could get that power without significant loss.
Yeah, you could probably get it to Ontario and the Maritimes, okay.
That leaves, I guess the prairies would have to be going off
BC and Manitoba.
Which would Saskatchewan's out of luck.
Yeah, and you know, it would not be hard to say, replace the coal plants around Edmonton with power from a, say, new dam in the Peace area.
I think I'd be even more supportive of this if we as a country could be more behind nuclear power, but that's just not cool anymore. It's not the 1950s.
Yeah, that is actually something interesting here. Not a single candidate's proposed nuclear as a effective low-carbon baseload.
You also notice none of them have talked about genetically modified organisms because they know a third rail that's not worth going after.
Yeah, which, I think that basically leaves, what, Deepak Oberoi is the only leadership candidate this year to have supported nuclear as a climate method.
Well, that's because most conservative candidates denied there was even a climate crisis. Back to Jagmeet on, you could call them identity issues. If you want, he's got all the bases covered. He's got a large, he labels it LGBTQI2S+ strategy. So he would promote youth housing initiatives to help queer youth who are marginalized and face higher suicide rates and other issues. For trans people, he would look to bring in a lot of gender equity rules and regulations around federal ID laws. So when you get a passport, there would either be a non-binary gender label, or you would be able to change that if you changed your gender identity or realized, I guess, you were a different gender identity than you were labeled at birth. And you'd also loosen some of the airport restrictions that sometimes discriminate against trans people who don't necessarily match what their passport explicitly says. He would also direct Health Canada to implement more policies for trans and intersex people. he'd repeal the blood ban, meaning men who have sex with men can't donate. I think it's now 1 year since their latest encounter versus it used to be 5 years. And Trudeau was on the I'll repeal the blood ban, and he relaxed it a bit. Outside of that, he has policies on gender-based violence and looking at a number of criminal justice reforms to protect women who have been sexually assaulted and make sure that we have a better prosecution rate for rape and sex assault crimes. He would also do a lot of criminal justice reforms around what comes down to racist policies or racist practices. Specifically, he would ban carding and the street checks that are happening. He would ban that within the RCMP. He can't affect provincial police. And this is something he's worked on as an MPP in Ontario with a number of people of color and activists there who highlighted it as an issue. At the JAG meet and greet, he talked about how he personally has been pulled over far more than any of his friends, especially when he drove his dad's fancy car. And so he looked to review whether there's systemic racism at play within the RCMP and seek to adjust broader criminal justice reforms. And because of his background in law, he's got a very comprehensive criminal justice reform, immediate end to solitary confinement, ending the mandatory minimums that Harper brought in, and a number of other Harper era criminal code reforms. He would do mandatory training for lawyers and judges, which the federal government has just agreed to have sexual assault trial training for judges, I believe.
Yeah, it was a private member's bill.
From Ron Ambrose, I think, yeah, following some high-profile cases. And that got cross-partisan support, which was good to see. He would also, he's the only one who mentioned addressing delays in the court system, which is actually a huge issue right now. The Supreme Court of Canada has twice ruled that in very recent couple of years that our criminal justice system is way too long. And if you now don't go to trial, I think it's in 12 months, your case will be thrown out. So the governments need to get on their act, and he's got an actual policy to start doing stuff and set up commissions to look at this. And he'd also, of course, throw money at hiring more lawyers so we can get stuff through, in addition to streamlining the system and trying to clear out some of the backlog. He also squeezed in his criminal justice reform, decriminalizing sex work. Just as a aside, he'd, I guess, undo the Harper response to the Bedford Supreme Court of Canada ruling. And he doesn't say how exactly he'd decriminalize it, just that he would. Speaking of decriminalizing, he'd also decriminalize marijuana immediately and offer full pardons to everyone who's been charged recently or in the system for it.
Yeah, although that one's a little weird because he isn't a federal MP, so even if in theory he could do it, like, marijuana will be legalized probably by the time he's in the House.
I think he's assuming Justin Trudeau will fuck it up. And so he's at least saying, the NDP line was, on the day of the election, if you're going to move towards legalization, you should be decriminalizing it in the meantime so people aren't still being thrown in jail like they're still being thrown in jail. And if you want to hear a big long rant about this, the new Docket podcast episode that I think came out today that I already listened to, Michael Spratt goes into a rant about why that's unjust. He would also, and he's the only candidate to talk about this, move to develop a path to decriminalize personal possession of all drugs and try to treat it more in a Portuguese-style healthcare approach rather than criminal justice approach. And he came out very strongly on that at the last debate. And similarly, he'd take harm reduction approaches to the opioid epidemic and basically healthcare in general. He's also the only one who explicitly mentioned repealing Bill C-51, the anti-terror legislation. And the one thing he doesn't have on his website, but he talked about it at the JAG meet and greet, was offering free tuition.
Which is one of those things that everyone's kind of doing some version of, make university cheaper, more accessible.
Well, of the candidates officially, only Nikki and Jagmeet are on the let's move towards eliminating tuition. And that is a provincial jurisdiction, so it's something where they say, all right, the federal government will throw a whole bunch of money at it if the provinces come on board.
If only Jagmeet was a provincial politician.
He's deputy leader of a third party. In the short term, though, he would, if federal prime minister, waive the interest on federal student loans, which is one of those low-hanging fruit that his argument is the federal government shouldn't be profiting off student loans. So Jagmeet's got lots in there in his policy. His biggest strength, though, I think, is just how much attention he's gotten. He's got the strongest organizing team, it seems. He signed up 47,000 of the 124,000 people who are members right now. He's raised the most money by far. And he's really actually got strongest organizations in a lot of immigrant communities, including South Asian communities in suburban Vancouver and Toronto, which are areas the NDP absolutely must win if they want to get government, because they're not good at winning the prairies anymore. Unfortunately, he potentially faces issues in Quebec.
And yeah, that becomes a viability question for people who might otherwise be on board.
This is basically, is Quebec too racist? I think we could also ask the same thing about Canada as a whole. I hope not. If he wins, hopefully we can move past that and just accept it. It'd sort of be like, if Nikki won, hopefully it wasn't the fact she's a woman, people wouldn't like her. Jagmeet's also, like you mentioned, not in parliament, and he said he's not going to seek a quick by-election win if he does win. He'd take a Jack Layton approach and just wait till the next election.
Often what happens, someone will resign who has the safe seat so the leader can come in on there. And there will be a by-election within the next 6 months because Arnold Chan, unfortunately, passed away today, the Liberal MP from Sarnia.
So Jagmeet has said he wouldn't take a run. I can imagine he'd want to run federally again in the same riding he just about won in 2011. That seems like a pretty good idea. And if he's got the momentum, he could probably swing that around. I can't imagine he'd stay on as leader from outside parliament if he loses an election. The other problem I've had with Jagmeet in this race is some of the positions he took were very almost late and of convenience, it seemed. In some of the early debates, they were arguing about Kinder Morgan and people were trying to pin him down, like, are you for it or are you against it? And whether or not you're for or against it, you want to at least know if he has a position. But Jagmeet said I'll have it coming out soon and you'll just have to wait and see. And he kind of waffled around on it. And eventually he came out against Kinder Morgan, but it was almost seemed like he just came out against because that's what the NDP membership wanted. And it was that way on a couple things where he sounded like too political by half. Maybe that's just the fact he's one of the younger candidates. He's 38, I think. Maybe he isn't as principled, which at a time when I think the NDP is looking for a bit stronger principles.
Yeah, he's also been tagged as the centrist as well. How fair that is.
Yeah, when I looked at his policy, he's... Maybe at the start he was the centrist, and maybe even in Ontario, the Ontario NDP has had that baggage for a while, probably since Bob Rae, and have had trouble shedding it if they wanted to. But I think they've also been angling for government, so they've taken on some centrist stuff. But the platform he has here is not a centrist platform by any stretch that I could argue. So Jagmeet's probably got the easiest chance to win. He'd be the odds-on favorite right now. All he needs to do is get the most votes on first ballot and just not piss too many other candidates off. Most votes,
that's how to win this one.
Yeah, get the most votes. I think, though, if he comes in behind Angus, his chance of winning doesn't just drop because he's second, but I think Angus has a better chance of picking up support from members who've been around for a long time versus Jagmeet is looking for... Here's a whole bunch of new members. Let's have them run the party. And this is something that's also annoyed a lot of people in the party. Jagmeet sends out a lot of fundraising emails and doesn't really talk about party renewal. But one way he also brought in a lot of members, which is a form of renewal when you go from a shrinking party to, well, now it's growing. It's just whether he's listening to the people who are coming in. Well, moving into the next section, after a long look at all of the policy, because when there's only four candidates, you think you can talk about all of them, and then there's a lot of stuff still to talk about. But the state of the race is, again, harder, I think, to tell than the Conservative race, because there's just been less coverage.
Although even that was hard to follow too.
Well, and that was even harder because there were so many candidates.
Yeah, the coverage didn't focus too much on Andrew Scheer. You know, the people who were looking at it, like, okay, how's the kind of campaign itself working, had him fairly high up in the probabilities of winning, but, you know, it didn't get reflected in the polling that came out.
So there's been less polling of the NDP leadership race than there was of the Conservatives. Main Street and iPolitics are thankfully doing the same polled donor data and poll them, so we do have some opinion polling. Main Street has basically found that in September, Singh was leading with 36% support to Angus's 33%, Ashton's 17%, and Curran's 13%. This is a shift from when Angus was leading with 42% in August and even leading with 35% in July, versus in those months Singh had 12-14%, and Ashton actually was at 32% for some reason in July and then down to 28% in August. And Curran has kind of bounced around from 10-17-13%. I guess the takeaway is there was maybe some initial excitement for Ashton, but it faded away, maybe in favor of Jagmeet Singh, or else it was a blip, because when I first saw Ashton was neck and neck with Angus, I was honestly pretty surprised. These numbers feel closer at the end, the 33-36 kind of split with the other two trailing behind. Again, it's really hard to pull, so we can't say if that's useful at all. The other numbers we have are the fundraising data. Jagmeet Singh has raised more than everyone else combined. He's in the second quarter, which ended, I think, in July, which is the newest numbers we have. So the hottest part of the race, the last, I guess, part of the summer, when everyone's ramping up into now. We won't know who raised the most until well after the election. But Jagmeet raised over 350,000 in Q2. Angus 123,000, Ashton 70,000, Curran 47,000. Singh had almost 1,700 supporters in that period, Angus 1,300, Ashton 1,000, and Curran 570. So they're a bit closer on supporters than the dollars, which suggests Singh's just a better fundraiser, but he still does have more support.
Yeah, and those fundraising can be useful for getting an idea of first ballot preferences. Holding fundraising ability equal, which is not, but you would expect the people with like the strongest support to have the higher fundraising numbers, because that's a sign of a strong supporter that they're willing to throw money down.
And the only other thing we can look at is just the membership data, where there are officially 123,798 eligible NDP members who can vote. Probably only half of them will, like most leadership contests. But Jagmeet was the only one to announce how many members he got. And he said he got 47,000, 30,000 of which were in Ontario. And of those Ontario ones, 25,000 were in the Greater Toronto Area. And then he got another 10,000 supporters in BC. So this is where Jagmeet's close to being able to clinch it, but still has some distance. The only other poll that really came out was from in early August. Main Street looked at this Quebec question and looked at who does the best in Quebec. And they found 1,800 NDP members in Quebec. And Guy Caron was seen as the most likely to gain seats, and Jagmeet Singh the most likely to lose seats in Quebec, which isn't so much a who would you vote for, but who do you think other people would vote for? And those are interesting to look at. That could just mean, do you think people, the other people in Quebec, are racist and wouldn't vote for someone who wears a turban? And people say yes, but maybe people can surprise you. So we don't have a good clear indicator of who will win, but I think the clear frontrunners are Singh and Angus. And I think Ashton has the edge on Curran, based on all the numbers, unless he can manage to pull in a lot of votes in Quebec, but there aren't that many members in Quebec still. All right, well, let's do one quick final section. How would you vote? Mine's been floating around.
You're gonna fill it out on the air here?
I have it in my mind, and I've posted tentative on Facebook before that my first choice. And the thing I'll say is that in a race like this, votes can mean different things. So my first choice has been Nikki Ashton and was in the previous race. And this time and that time, I don't think she has any chance of winning, at which point it becomes more of a symbolic vote about which direction I want to see the NDP going. One of the things I was hearing on a British podcast, it was talking a bit about Corbyn and Brexit and Trump and what is the mood right now. And one of their diagnoses was people are looking for big solutions, big ideas. There are good ideas, or progressive ideas, at least from their point of view. And then there's dangerous ideas. But people want to change and people want some big commitments. And I think Nikki and even Jagmeet are starting to present those. I had put Charlie Angus second in my ballot for a long time. I think he's got a lot of positives, but after seeing Jagmeet and going deeper into the policies, Charlie slips a little in my ranking. I'm still not sure. I still like his party renewal, but I think Jagmeet's got a more rounded platform, especially on the civil liberties and justice reform, which I think are fundamental. Guy Caron's been sitting at the bottom of my ballot, and I feel bad about that because he's such a nice human being and has a very detailed good ideas, but I just don't see him winning or really exciting the party at a time when it needs excitement. And I think the rest of them bring at least some energy, whether positive or radical in whatever way. So right now I have Nikki on top and Guy on bottom. How would you vote if you would?
Yeah, well, I don't have a membership.
Or who do you think would win, Len?
In terms of who I think would win, I think, yeah, smart money's on Jagmeet, just from how well he's done on the organization and getting new members. Does seem to have the momentum going for him, but, you know, I wouldn't rule out Angus either. And, you know, we've seen there have been some upsets this year where it looked like the momentum candidate was going to win and then suddenly stalled out in the final round. In terms of who I'd vote for, I mean, I've already said who my last place pick would be. And then just comes to, yeah, in terms of where the rest would sit, it's...
Or even thinking about it this way, if there was a federal election and you had these four parties to choose from, which would be your least bad option?
Yeah, I like the policy wonkiness of Guy Caron, even if I'm a little skeptical of whether or not the math really works out on basic income, although in his version it seems fairly affordable because it's not actually that ambitious as far as basic incomes go. And the high-speed rail seems like a good idea, increasing the carbon tax. So I'd probably put Guy Caron as top, even if I'm just a bunch of stuff I'm not on board with there.
Like his Quebec.
Yeah, his Quebec stuff, some of the other tax stuff he has in there. And in terms of Angus and Jagmeet, it's hard to say. I think I'd probably lean towards Jagmeet just because a lot of his stuff is means-tested.
I almost thought you said memes tested for a second because I was just thinking about how he did a Snapchat at the end of his Jagmeet and greet.
Yeah, there's probably a few Jagmeet memes as well, but he does seem more on the memes tested than the memes testing.
All right, well, voting starts on September 18th, so we'll, I'm sure, come back to this when we have the results of the first ballot and we can talk about it in whatever episode that is in a few weeks.
And that has been PolitTrust Deep Dive into the NDP leadership race. Find links to the candidates and their platforms in the show notes at politrust.ca. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitTrustPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.